This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, first thing I want to do is, Garrett, act like I all of a sudden just fell over dead. And it was just silence. And you had to be like, and you all of a sudden had to step into the role of being the host. The reason I'm doing this is because this is the first one Giannis Boutelis. I think this is the first Meat Eater Podcast that Giannis Boutelis was not here. Because now he's now got a crippled up knee. He feels as though he's going to get better. I've written him off. It just seems to me once someone's knee goes bad, it's just, they're done. So, here I am. I've fallen over dead. What would you, how would you proceed?
I'd say moment of silence for Yanni's knee. And then I'd ask Rick, man, I couldn't do it.
You wouldn't just jump into like.
No, you'd make me do it, Garrett?
I'm totally unqualified.
So,
but it began. The conversation began then.
That was the voice of Garrett Smith, and then as though dealing poker, the Corey, and just introduce say a few things about yourself.
My name's Corey Kaczmarek, sometimes Kaczmarek, sometimes Kaczmarek.
I like it. Depending on how Russian they're feeling or Polish.
Polish. Or? So this is my I'd say seventh Meat Eater as far as working with these guys as a cameraman. But
tell them some of the other cameraman stuff you do.
I do this show called Mountain Man, where we follow around, or Mountain Men, excuse me, where we follow around guys living up in the woods, up in the mountains, killing animals for food. I do snowboard, extreme sport filming, some documentaries here and there, commercial work.
You worked out that new movie, Unbranded.
Unbranded, yeah. We took 16 wild Mustangs from Mexico all the way up to Canada. It took us 5.5 months. I rode about 1,000 miles of the ride.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah. Learned a lot about horses.
And you were riding.
I rode, yeah, 1,000.
Were you filming were you trying to film from the horse?
We did. We did film with a little DSLR camera off the horse, and then we'd get off the horse, run ahead about until we were out of breath, you know, set up a shot, and they ride by, and then we have to catch up with them. And, you know, we did that for 3,000 miles, me and my buddy Phil Baraboo. And, no, it's a good success. You guys got to check it out. It's on Netflix right now.
Yeah, Phil Baraboo filmed 3 Meat Eater shows.
He did.
Sorry, Mo.
I've seen it on Netflix, and I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen the card.
It got like
there,
heavy
man.
Treatment on Netflix.
I'm excited to see it now, man. I've had it queued up a couple times, and like kind of
you can't go wrong with
else.
Cowboys.
But now I'm going home directly to watch it, man.
Does it take a pro wild horse or does it try to stay like how does it fall on the political not the political but you know like the there's a debate about wild horses where some people feel like we should treat them like a native wild animal and some people feel like it's feral livestock.
We're right down that middle line there.
They explain that debate.
Yeah, everyone gets their. You know, fair share of as far as like debating their side. And I think we did a good job at keeping it right down the middle, explain both sides of the story. And in the end, you know, you kind of make up the decision about, you know, I guess there is no end for the horse. Like there is, it's an open-ended story, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to hunt them.
Yeah.
And eat them.
Now, speaking of that, we're up on Prince Wales Island right now. I want to get back to that. I definitely want to get back to that.
It's not like out of this world.
I want to get back to that. That's real important that you just said that.
We're on Prince Wales Island.
We're just out running shrimp traps tonight, and Mo is naming off a number of places where he's eaten horse.
Yeah. I mean, and enjoyed it. Yeah.
I haven't introduced you.
Well,
yet,
I was getting to that, but I was just kind of ease into it. You know, bridging off that.
I'm an aggressive host.
It's called a segue in editing. I was kind of trying to build a nice natural one.
Oh, sorry. Please.
Yeah, I'm Morgan or Mo Fallon. I've been the first time we worked together was almost 8 years ago now, on a number of little pilots. As you were,
was I married or not married? That's how I would know when it was.
You were married. You were all
so it was 8 years ago.
Yeah, you were always married. But we did a number of little pilots together as we kind of geared up for figuring out what would be a show. You know, kind of based on, I guess, your philosophies and lifestyle and, you know, stuff. And then did a show for Travel Channel together, for which I was the director of photography. And then moved on to start doing these, the Meat Eater shows, which I was originally the director of photography on. Then I kind of segued into directing, which was the beginning of me starting to direct things, which is what I've continued on doing, moving from cinematography to directing. So I've been a cinematographer for 15 years.
Yeah, because you worked on, when you were young, like just starting out, you worked on Ali.
Big feature films, yeah. Yeah, I was Michael Mann's assistant for 2 years, right out of school, which was a kind of an amazing experience.
And he made Miami Vice.
Yeah, I mean, he made Miami Ali. Vice, the TV show, but he also made, I mean, his great films are like Last of the Mohicans, which is like a masterpiece. Heat,
I think, is...
It's also a masterpiece.
Yeah, dude.
Inside, The Insider,
mm-hmm.
It's also a masterpiece. You know, I mean, dude, Collateral is a good film. Maybe not a masterpiece, but...
You still talk to him?
You know, I ran into him at the Directors Guild in L.A. Like a few months ago at a screening for The Revenant. It was really interesting. I hadn't seen him in almost 15 years. I was a 24-year-old kid coming out of film school and worked for, you know, directly for one of the biggest directors in the world. I went from, like, you know, living in a crappy dorm room to, like, flying on a private jet, you know, to Africa with him. It was a real head trip.
How'd that happen? Not to interrupt, but.
No, you know, it was interesting. I got a 2-day job as a PA to fill in for someone in his office.
Explain what that means.
It's a production assistant job. It's like entry level in film and television production as a production assistant.
Can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah,
we have a role that we made up called a WPA,
right?
Wilderness production assistant.
Yeah. That would be like, that would be a level above, you know, a normal PA, because it requires some additional skills that are somewhat esoteric. You know, for me, it was like, can you make coffee and clean up?
Like literally make coffee.
Yeah.
That would be a job.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Make coffee the way Michael likes coffee made. Which, trust me, is a high pressure situation. If you think it's not a high pressure situation, you don't know Michael Mann.
So when you're doing that, are you thinking, oh yeah, I'll wind up like directing shows? And I mean, does it just seem like,
definitely,
how in the world?
But I thought I'd end up directing feature films. I really thought I'd go down like a narrative and feature film path.
Yeah.
You know, but the more and more. The more I was exposed to like documentary filmmaking, the more I realized that it really fits my, I guess my God-given talents, you know, my particular set of like inherent skills, you know, better than, you know, looking at a script and making a feature film, which is very like a very... I mean, look, it's an art form, so I'm not talking down on it at all. But it's a very contrived art, you know. I don't think that was particularly right for me in the end. But what was very right was, you know, documentary, which is you exist in the moment, you know, and you use your instinct and your skills. You know, and you're problem solving on a moment to moment basis, which
for me, was like very appealing because you're figuring out the story as you go along. You know,
tell the other tell the show you worked on for a long time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh yeah, yeah.
Biggest Loser. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean,
for how many years did you do that?
I did 3 years of Biggest Loser, 96 episodes.
And then talk about what you've been doing in the 3.5 years since because we worked together for years. I mean, together for years. Yep. I mean, we're still in communication all the time, but we worked together for years. And then we still work with the same company.
Yes.
But now you do.
Now
direct episodes of.
Yeah. So I direct a couple of different shows now. A show called Mind of a Chef, which is based on, I mean, you know, it is what it is. It's, you know, 8 episode seasons of based on a chef. So we'll pick a chef and like kind of dissect their life, their philosophies. And that's a very, very fun show to work on because it's like total creative freedom. We can look at, you know, we can look at a chef and come up with all kinds of wild ways to tell their story. Then I also am a cinematographer and director on Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown, which is a show on CNN, which is like a food, travel, culture, kind of political, kind of everything else kind of show, you know, which is a little different in that it's a host-based show, you know, so it's, you know, it's one host all the time, Anthony Bourdain, you know, and it's really his looking at the world through his filter, you know.
How many of those do you do every year?
You know, I used to shoot, when I was just shooting them, I would shoot 8 or 9 a year, and now that I'm directing them, that really limits the amount you can get out, so I do 2, maybe I'll do 3 next year directing. And then I'll probably shoot 2 of them as well.
Not directing,
but as a cinematographer. But that's about as much time as I can get in, you know. Because, I mean, directing, you're 2.5 months in or 2 months in pre-production just sitting at a computer, you know. Then you're 10, 11, 12 days in the field filming, and then you're, you know, another 6 to 8 weeks or so sitting in front of a computer again as you edit the, you know, as you edit the show.
Yeah, it's engrossing.
So, yeah, it's engrossing, time-wise. Man. It's engrossing. They're little films, you know. But, yeah, I mean, really very rewarding show as well. So, yeah, and then, you know, hopefully more of these now, man.
Yeah,
you know,
Modus did his first, that your first guesting?
Yeah, man.
Guesting on a show?
Yeah, it's funny. After all this time, it's the first time I've really been on camera for the duration of a show, you know, and felt like kind of what it's like to stand on the other side and have someone like point a camera at you and be like, okay, so now say something cool.
Yeah.
And try to come up with interesting, you know, shit that you think people would be, you know, would want
to
hear.
And then you're forced to, like, you have to appreciate the importance of coming up with something because you deal with the other end of trying to put the stuff together later.
Yeah.
You realize it's, like, no good when you bomb out.
Yeah, right? Definitely. You get into some weird, you know, in my position here, you get into some weird, like, Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty kind of stuff where, like, I'm kind of... I realize as I'm doing this, I'm kind of tainting the process. I mean, if you're like going to talk about like pure documentary stuff, just the fact that I have so much inside knowledge, I'm like, I was aware as we went through this process that I was like clearly manipulating some things inside,
you're
you know,
about,
because I
you're
know
about the later product.
Yeah, I know how it'll cut together and how it'll all work, and you know. The hardest thing with shows like this, which is that, you know, it's very, very difficult to get the amount of ideas and material that you want to get across to tell a story into 22 minutes. You know, it is a real, difficult process, you know.
Well, when we sit around, well, let me come back to that because I'm going to say what I was going to say real quick because I'll forget. When we sit around, we'll be like, yeah, we want to, like, we're coming up, we want to do an episode about dads, right?
Yeah.
Giannis, his dad, you know, brought him up hunting and has a lot of really interesting ideas about what he thought his kids would get out of going to hunting camp and being exposed to this sort of cycle of there's a handful of guys that hang out and they meet every year and sort of how you interact and how you kind of come together and fulfill, you know, and pursue goals and come into this camp and assign people like different tasks and make the whole thing work smoothly and get along well and bury differences and know what subjects are sort of just not good to bring up and just how to hang out.
Yeah.
You know, and he felt that it was like a great gift to his son to bring him in that world. We've had these conversations, so we're like, okay, we should do an episode about dads, you know, and Giannis's dad's always dreamed of going on a moose hunt, so we're going to take him on a moose hunt.
Cool.
Yeah. And in the end, you know, we keep talking about like the dad's thing, right? Like Giannis's dad, the dad's yeah. thing. To us, it feels that way. When you watch it, they'll be like, these guys were hunting moose. And there was a this, and there was that, and there was a bear, and yeah. oh yeah, someone's dad was there. And it'll yeah. be like, but it really feels like you're going to, it really feels like you want to make a comment about dads.
Definitely, yeah.
Because it winds up being in this kind of thing where there's all this like uncertainty and action stuff and, you know, shooting guns and chopping yeah. animals up and shit. Like the thing you were wanting to talk about sometimes only winds up being like a hint.
Yeah, but if I can interject real quickly before you move on too. One of the reasons why that's so difficult to do is that if you were to make a show where you're like, I want to talk about dads, and you came out of the gate just swinging and like wanted to relay all your information and all your thoughts and feelings about dads and all the stuff you want to get across in a show, so it would feel so phony and preachy and you know, up its own ass that it wouldn't work. There's a way that when you go into the edit that you have to divulge a story that, you know, is kind to the audience, you know, mm-hmm. that allows the audience to get a sense of tone and place and feel a sense that they're involved in the story, that they have some stake before you're able to sell high concept ideas. You know, and so you realize, like, in a 22-minute show, by the time you've set all that stuff up, you know, and you've brought them into the experience, and you want to now divulge your information, you have very little time to yeah. do that and then tell the rest of the story points that get you from A to B. Like, you got to then actually kill a moose and then butcher a moose and then, you know, have a meal out of that moose. It just becomes that the time to get ideas across is so whittled down that what you end up with is like, well, okay, what's the most concentrated salient point that I can interject at this one particular place where I can get an idea in? Because that's about my only shot.
Yeah, to have it become the show about dads.
Exactly.
I think of it yeah. as being somewhere between 90-10 and 80-20. Like, we wanted to do the thing about Aldo Leopold, okay? Yeah. When it's all said and done, it'll be probably about, if you broke out the minutes or the seconds or whatever, yeah. maybe about 10%.
Yeah.
About the one thing we talked about going into it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But those are like the shackles of the 22-minute, you know, format. It just...
Well, we're saying 22 minutes, we're talking about a 30-minute television show.
That's right.
Like, once you cut out the ads, yeah. you got 22 yeah. minutes,
you
yeah.
know. You know, so that's like a standard form for the television industry is like 20, you know, a half hour 22, a 1 hour 44, you know. You find that like a 44-minute show seems like it should be harder to make, and it's like way, way easier to make a good one, you know, because you actually have some breathing room and some time that you can, you know, that you can get your ideas across and really like structure something that is interesting for people to watch, brings them into the story and the experience, and is like coherent, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, you know, but I like them personally. I like the 22s because they're very challenging, you know, they're challenging. And when you get a good one, you like feel real proud of that. And it's a nice digestible size show for people to watch.
You know? I used to hate it, but now I like it.
Yeah. I think it's better in a lot of ways when you can do it well. You know. Anyways.
Rick?
Yeah.
My name is Rick Smith. I'm not a hunter, but I filmed a lot of wildlife stuff and started writing and kind of helping produce some of the Apex Predator episodes with Remy, who is like the master hunter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good. I always knew I wanted to get
out. Is that your first time being out hunting?
Yeah. Yeah, I always felt some of the wildlife stuff that I was doing was like hunting with a camera. You know, a lot of grizzly bear stuff where you were stalking and getting close, but it was just with a camera in some way. So it felt pretty natural to do it. But I really respected the ZBZ who makes all this stuff with no reservations. So as I was coming up as a in film school and figuring out what I wanted to do, I saw no reservations, and I was like, that's the kind of stuff I wanted to make. Stylistic, beautiful, but it felt very authentic. And so I was super excited to start working on Apex, and then this is my second Meat Eater show. And
yeah, we did Old Mexico, and
yeah, it was awesome.
Now what so you went to film school?
Yeah,
how did you get into, did you go into it being like that you wanted to film wildlife?
I mean, I really had no idea. My undergraduate degree was in biology, and I knew I didn't want to be a biologist.
Did you know what that meant?
Being a biologist?
Yeah.
Like, no, you just
can't. I mean, did it wind up being like a university thing?
Right, well, I did research, and, you know, all the professors I spoke with were like, it's not really, nobody seemed very enthused about what they were doing. I think that's just a matter of old people just talking about work, period. But I wasn't convinced that I was going to be able to do what I wanted to do, which is largely go on a lot of adventures. So I thought, documentary film. I like film. I like film and stuff. I had no idea what that meant. And I went to a grad program in Bozeman. It's an MFA in Science and Natural History documentary film. And I had no idea what that meant. I made
some. Call it back up. It's a what?
It's like
science and documentary film are rolled into.
Yeah, so the premise was to take people trained in science and train them in filmmaking.
Was it like you and another guy?
No, it's, I mean.
No, that makes sense.
There's like a lot of people in
Well, in Bozeman, it's like, yeah, there's all these folks that are, I mean, it's kind of taken over the industry, at least in some aspects of it. A lot of guys working for the BBC.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Winning some big awards, producing stuff for Nat Geo. A lot of folks work for NASA. I mean, but the skill set is kind of, you know, it's not exclusive. You're trained as a scientist, then you have to learn, like, storytelling. So it takes a little while to figure it out. But, it's a weird program, but I wanted to be in Bozeman, and I didn't know what else to do, so.
So break it down how you were just recently doing a job, but your job was just go out and collect footage of animals doing animal shit.
Yeah.
With, I mean, just like
behavior, yeah. So, I mean, a big part
like of... Like a checklist?
Well, a big part of the natural history filmmaking deal is you're having to tell stories with just animals. There's no host. There's no nothing. They call it blue chip wildlife, you know, television or film. And yeah, you're shooting behavior and the progression, whether it be over the course of a season, but these animals' lives in a way that people can watch it and actually care. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're out hunting, you start to, if you watch an animal long enough, you start to understand their story. Well,
you often catch them at the tail end of their life too.
That's exactly right. But you're, you know, when you have hours and hours of watching an animal, well, the story unfolds slowly and over the whole season. But to do it in a 22-minute show or a, you know, 44 minutes, you have to be very, I guess, precise about the imagery you get that tells the story of the animals that are out there.
Well, okay, you know when you're watching a shitty wildlife documentary?
Yeah.
And they'll show, like, a rabbit, just looking like a rabbit, and then they show a raptor.
Yeah.
And then they show a rabbit, and then they show a raptor, and then they show a rabbit, and then they show a raptor, and you never see the raptor and the rabbit together. And then all of a sudden there's a raptor that maybe is the same one or maybe a different one eating some nondescript hunk of meat on a fence pole.
Right.
And they build it out as though the raptor, like,
total artifice, right?
So yeah, they're so do you make those things?
Well, we're trying not to, but the show that I'm working on is for the Smithsonian Channel. And in the grand scheme of like natural history films that the BBC makes, really expensive. A lot of days in the field. So it's a time-intensive, money-intensive thing to make a good natural history show. The show I'm working on doesn't have a huge budget, but we're trying to not make it suck. So
to get both things in the same shot.
You're trying to be, just like we're talking about this show, you're trying to be authentic. And the audiences can read bullshit.
Yes.
And there's maybe a percentage of the population that doesn't care one way or another, but good documentary film has a level of authenticity to it. So the audience at the end of the day knows if they're getting fucked with, you know, if something's happening, like if there's the rabbit and the raptor and they never actually interact, but you can construct the narrative in a way that doesn't reflect the actuality of what happened. And I mean, that's just the reality of making documentaries, right? In some ways.
But what are you beginning with? Like, what is your, when you're doing a job like that, when you wake up in the morning, are you just a slave to whatever happens that day?
The shows that you decide you want to make about dads, like, we have a premise that we want to go shoot.
And you're aware of the premise.
Yeah. You know, gotcha. The overall structure. But in the end.
Like the year of a bear, let's say.
Right. Right. But you're sort of, the story is going to reveal itself in whatever actually happens. To some degree. You can try to, I don't know, enable a certain situation to occur or be there at the right time and the right place. But more or less, you get what you get out there. So.
And what percent of your work do you do in national parks? And what percent do you do out of national parks?
Yeah, so I don't do a ton of just pure natural history stuff. Most of my work has been host-based adventure filmmaking where I'm following a host, much like yourself, doing something. And it's kind of a hybrid of pure natural history with some humans in there. But most of it, you know, any good wildlife sequence, most of it takes place in situations where the animals are habituated. This doesn't mean they're not wild places, but they're used to seeing people.
Yeah.
You go to a place where certain animals are not used to seeing you, and they're just gonna run away. They're just gonna be like, if it's super novel, maybe they'll like come close to you. But more or less, you have to be in a place where it's like a weird congregation, where your chances of seeing something are pretty good. And the distances required, like, I mean, to get a decent shot, even with a huge telephoto lens, less than 100 yards.
Gotcha.
So that's close when it comes to these animals that don't want to be around you. So,
but when that guy finally got that shot of the snow leopard in, what's the program?
Planet Earth.
That was Planet Earth.
Yeah.
I heard that he was like 1,000 yards, like some absurd distance away.
He was really far, but that was a place that was like a known place. But he definitely spent a lot of time in a blind.
Yeah, but he spent like 3 weeks in a blind for that shot.
For that shot. But I know another guy that's working on a show. I think it's funded by the Chinese, but I think it's for Disney Nature. And he got some amazing stuff in Tibet.
Snow leopards,
like way close, and it was largely because they had a set of individual cats that were okay with their presence, and they never put the stock on. They never like threatened them because the cats know they're there, and they got some amazing stuff. So it's really finding individuals or populations that allow you to get close enough to tell the story that otherwise mostly can't be told. Most wild animals don't want anything to do with people. So
I was talking to these guys down in Fort Bragg where one of the special forces groups is based out of Fort Bragg. I can't remember what number. And I went down there to hang out, and these guys told me a story that one night they were in a pass in Afghanistan, staking out a pass. Did I tell you this?
I think you might have, but that's a good story. I'll tell you.
They catch some guys. They catch some suspected Taliban guys coming through the pass. And they start shooting at him, and one of them is carrying a big recoilless rifle. And they wing the guy, and he drops the rifle. And then his friends drag him back down out of sight. And the guy sat there all night with a thermal scope, you know, watching to so he could hit whoever came out to get that rifle because he knew someone was probably going to come get that rifle. And as he's watching that night, a snow leopard came out and smelled the blood where that guy got hit. And he saw it.
It's awesome.
Yeah. A lot of people will never lay, myself included, will never lay eyes on one of those things.
Just cats.
Peter Matheson wrote a whole damn book, never saw one.
Yeah.
It's like, it's
good book, though.
No, it's like mountain lions out, you know, around Bozeman, or there was one at MSU, Montana State University. There was one spotted on campus at like 2 in the morning. I got a text alert, like, watch out for the mountain lion. But,
oh, really?
But there's cats out there, and you'll never see them. And they're there watching you, and they're mostly, you know, never going to do anything. They don't eat people. Otherwise, they would eat people, right? I mean, they kill like a deer a week or something.
I thought
they
ate hikers in L.A.
Oh, I'm
you have a better chance of winning the lottery and getting struck.
I don't. It's like I'm not saying this. Introduce yourself, Eric. Now that you've ruined the entire conversation.
My name is Eric Osterholm. I'm a producer and director at the same company that Mo works at, and that your shows, you know, produce on 0.0. And mostly have done travel adventure production.
Yeah, all around the damn world.
All around the damn world. Yeah, lots of crazy stories from different corners, remote places. But my first hunt was actually, or that I was anywhere near, was with you 5 or 6 years ago, that doll sheep hunt.
Is that right?
Yeah. Never been on a hunt before. Yeah.
And then before then and after then, you worked for other...
Yeah, I bounced around a bit, yeah.
Like freelance lifestyle.
Freelance lifestyle, yeah, which I think, Corey and Rick here also enjoy, and Mo has in the past, bouncing between... different shows, different adventures in different corners of the world. I lived in Alaska for a little bit doing a rescue show, which was pretty wild. Rescued a couple hunters in like remote spots.
Really?
Yeah.
There was their problem?
I just remember there was, it's all kind of blended together. I do remember there was like an 82-year-old guy who was just out on a remote island, off on his own, had hunted all his life and was, ended up having to call in to be rescued, but really didn't actually want to be rescued. He was just tough as nails and kind of just wanted like a resupply of some water and some food so he could keep hunting. So it was, some interesting experience.
He called 911. No. Let's not get carried away.
Yeah.
Water.
Some water. Some Bobo bars. What was he hunting for?
I don't know. It was a really long time ago. But I imagine probably... It was up near Sitka, so I don't know what's on the islands outside of Sitka.
Probably deer.
Yeah. But yeah, everything from rescue shows to been down to Antarctica a couple times, spent some time in Afghanistan, lots of different places.
Lots of Africa.
Yeah, lots of Africa. Yeah. Yeah. I think the biggest takeaway is something that we were talking about earlier today, which is just perspective. You know, you gain so much perspective on different people's, you know, where they came from, their perceptions, and it helps you not to jump basically to conclusions because everyone has a completely different paradigm. You know, you realize very quickly when you step outside of your own neck of the woods, so to speak. Yeah.
It's a little shocking.
Yeah. Yeah. Surprising.
And now you're full-time. You're a full-timer.
Yeah. Yeah, very recently full-time at CPZ and just moved to Montana, which is exciting. I was reluctantly living in Manhattan for a long time. I left Colorado. There aren't as many trees or mountains for me in Manhattan, so I was kind of running around like a nutcase. I think people saw me on my bike pulling my skis like behind me through Manhattan, like kicking off yellow cabs quite often, or like ice climbing stuff on my backpack. And
heading where?
Heading like either to get to a train or a plane to like escape.
Oh, to go. Yeah,
to escape out. Yeah.
I remember one time walking in New York, and I'd found a deer skull in Wyoming and gave it to Chris and Lydia, who own 0.0, or, you know, two of the, yeah, the founders. And a while later, they pointed out to me that there's these little pyramids of dust underneath the skull all the time. And I realized there's still some dermifted beetles, or like some carrion beetles, living in the skull, and they were still active. And I was like, well, I'm going to take it home and clean it. So I'm walking. I didn't have anything to put in it, so I'm just walking down into the subway station with a deer head. A skull with antlers on it, some dried hair and stuff on it still. This guy sees it, and he's so insistent that I sell it to him that he comes into my, he like gets into my subway car with me. Just, he's flabbergasted by this thing. Any amount of money is fine, you know? And I'm trying to explain to him, like, listen, you don't understand. The nation is awash in these things. You just don't know because of where you live that they're laying on the side of the road. This is not like this seems very unusual. You know, it seems like highly unusual. It's just not. You don't need to give me hundreds. You can go get a, you know, a forky deer antler. It's a big world out there, buddy. And it's full of deer skulls.
Did you want to take the money at one moment? Or
here's the thing. I would have in a second, but I'd already given it to Chris and Lady, right, and they loved it. But they just didn't want it in their office. Like he didn't even know. He said, every time I pick it up, there's like little sawdusty things underneath it. And you know, they're still in there eating the whatever out of there. So I couldn't then go like, oh, hey, you know, I know you want me to take it home and clean it, but I sold it to a guy in the subway.
Here's your cut.
But yeah, perspective. Now, Dirt, you, Dirt Myth, explain again why they call you, but explain Dirt Myth again. I feel like this is my favorite story in the world.
I had that's the name of my photography company, and it came from, I had a speech impediment when I was young, and I'd introduce myself as Dirt Myth, Garrett Smith.
Because you couldn't say Garrett Smith.
Yeah, I said Dirt Myth. Amongst other wrong words, which still happens. I still make up words occasionally, but not as bad.
So nobody's calling him Dirt.
Yeah. Now, it's a compliment.
Garrett does more on this production than he does everything. He's running the podcast machine right now. He's like mixing the audio.
He's a horse. I'm just pretending.
He's a horse in the field.
You must have had, what, a 100-pound pack with a camera with sticks on your shoulder the whole time?
I don't know, but I was saved by Rick and Eric when I about went down the mountain with that weight.
That was scary.
Yeah, that was a close call.
Like, we joke about, like, oh, you know, it was pretty sketchy terrain or tough terrain. I mean, there was a point that Garrett fell, and if he didn't stop tipping over with a big pack on, he would have died.
Oh, no.
Lost a leg.
I mean, you were inches away from the tipping point from which you would not have regained control.
Yeah,
and you wouldn't have walked
and
out.
And it was. I don't want to say you would have died. It was significant consequences.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, you think Yanni's got problems? Yeah. We're joking about Dirt self arresting with a hunk of his own leg bone.
That was about it.
This is classic. This is Garrett. Just in general, is everything's okay all the time, even if it's not. As he's falling, he says, I'm okay.
As of right now.
I'm good.
Before I go over this little cliff.
Don't rip my new pants.
Yeah. Still in motion. Yeah, and then you're like, watch the pants. Yeah. Someone's holding on to your pants to keep you from pitching over a 30-foot drop.
But, you know, everybody knows the midnight ride of Paul Revere. There was the midnight hike of Dirt Mill.
That was heroic, man.
What kind of, but not really, because
I messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot.
Later, when you explained what you were seeing, I realized that
that was a heroic effort, man.
It all gets
whether you messed up or not.
GPS on the way down.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, that was a heroic effort.
On the way up.
Yeah. No GPS, hiking out at night in... This is rough terrain in parts in a
bushwhack sense. If you rated bushwhacks, and there is a bushwhack rating scale, I'm interested in looking at. It was explained to me, but it would have to be on a 1 to 10. This is like an 8 bushwhack.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Because sure. There's no Devil's Club.
There's no Devil's Club.
Push it up into the 9.
That's right.
9 or 10.
Yeah. No, I've been up that hill. And that is a 9 or 10, man. But no Devil's Club, but it is, I mean, that's
thick.
That's significant. It's just like, man.
Yeah, it's confusing.
And to come down in the dark at night with only the range of view of your headlamp alone.
I think the choice to go down the drainage,
yeah,
which we initially were like, uh-oh, he's going down the drainage. That was a good move.
Again, though, teamwork. Like, I had communication with you guys.
Yeah, we had radio.
And once I knew that would empty close, it was an easy call. So that was, yeah,
you were moving with, like, fear motivating you because it took us about 2.5 going down with heavy packs.
Hours, you know. Yeah. You ripped down there. You got down pretty quick.
Man, I was nervous.
Well, why did you come back up, man?
Yeah. I wanted there was bourbon down here. I was like, whatever
it takes. Is that what happened? All that? I was hoping you'd bring the bourbon back up.
I thought about it.
Dude, I want to address the fish shack used to have such an ample. The alcohol section used to run from that first aid kit over to that really old bottle of separated honey. And it was just like, it was 4.5 feet of liquor.
Yeah.
It's down to 2 Bacardi bottles that
empty.
Have, you know, the dimple on the bottom of a bottle? The Bacardi doesn't come up to the bottom of the dimple. And then I think a Jägermeister's been here, I think, since we bought this place.
Well, who drinks Jägermeister, man? I mean,
someone thought it was a good idea to bring up. That way you're guaranteed to always have a little bit of liquor. Mo, explain why we went up the mountain.
Why we went up the mountain.
Yeah, just talk about what we were doing.
Here this particular time.
Yeah, but we were on
this was a
damn,
you know,
deer hunt.
Yeah, this was a was my second deer hunt.
Yeah, I didn't say first deer hunt.
No, I know.
Oh, okay.
Just trying to tell the story, man. But I like to start with a solid, you know.
be authentic.
I have a way of divulging the story.
Listen, man, I don't know why I'm directing you, man. I guess it's just like a chance I have to direct you, and I just can't turn it down.
No, that's fine. Yeah, you know. It was my second deer hunt. But more importantly than any of that, it was this is the spot of kind of our first real, you know, our first real like endeavor in this field, or in this genre, like together, you know, working. We had done some of the pilots, like I said, ramping up, but those were really just like dicking around, getting to know each other, kind of ramping up, figuring out what a show would be. We came here 6 years ago on the Travel Channel show, Wild Within, on the first episode. And it was the first time that like all the gears were kind of engaged and we were really going after the kind of show that we ultimately wanted to make.
That people would see.
And that would be kind of out there in the public eye. And, you know, like, you know, it was interesting that you have to also kind of take into consideration the context at that time, like 6 years ago with what was available on TV. But on mainstream television, people weren't doing content about hunting. You know, even at that time, I know there were executives within the network there that were leery about what we're doing and were constantly trying to put their like shine on it. Well, like, well, it's not a hunting show. And I'd be like, well,
sure, there's a lot of hunting.
Really? Because we're doing a lot of hunting. So, you know, but I think people were and I understand their position. I you know, I think it was people were very leery of like how that would be accepted on like a mainstream network, you know. But besides that, it was the first time that we had the funding and in the crew and the implementation and the technology and kind of a little bit of the know-how to go out and kind of figure out what, you know, how would we do this in an authentic way, that wouldn't either, you know, ruin, the standards that we hope to achieve in terms of television production, but also wouldn't, you know, ruin the hunt. Which is a delicate balance, you know. I mean, cameras are difficult animals in of themselves. They're very finicky and they require a lot of attention, you know, and a lot of input. And
I mean,
lot
just
of,
to keep them working.
Well, no, not even just to keep them working, but to keep
like myself as a camera operator or a DP at that time in a position that I would be getting a shot that would be telling a story. Yeah. You know what I mean? So meaning to say, what I'm getting at is a very complex way of saying that, like, it's hard not to spook animals because, you know, we want to tell the story in a way that's the most conducive to, like, divulging a story and building a story and making it entertaining and exciting. And, like, we're good at that. I know exactly where I would ideally like to be, you know, on various shots. And by shots, I mean camera shots, you know, to document a hunt. That is not necessarily conducive to what you know, actually stocking up on an animal requires, you know. So there was a lot of learning in that. You know, but like I said, it was, you know, that was the first time we were full up and running and going. And it was a very exciting time in all of our lives because we were really figuring out and writing the genre like as we went along because no one had really done a show, I think, like this. And by the way, I don't know enough of what was out there at the time in the hunting world to be 100% correct about this. So there may be people who are like, well, you're not taking into consideration this show or that show or the work of this person or that person. But in my perception, and to the extent that I know,
well, you're familiar with network television at the time.
I'm familiar with network television for sure. But, what I'm trying to say is that I don't know that there was a hunting show that was doing kind of what we were trying to do at that time. We had talked a lot then about like hunting shows as being made by hunters who were interested in picking up a camera and like documenting what they were seeing, but didn't necessarily have like the television savvy to be like, well, here's how you articulate like a complex narrative with dramatic highs and lows and, you know, tell a beautiful and like cinematic story that has some like gravitas, you know. We were TV folks that didn't know anything about hunting, really didn't particularly know anything about being out of doors, you know, who had become, by virtue of like meeting you and getting to understand your world, like interested in making shows about hunting and about this world and about, you know, how you live. And that was like a steep learning curve when those worlds came together because you don't, you know, it's not like, you know, in a normal job, like when I'm working Biggest Loser, like I show up at 11 o'clock in the morning at call time, hit the burrito truck, you know, for craft service and go get my camera ready. And like, there's a whole list of shots and just stuff to accomplish. This was like really writing the entire textbook as we went along because we didn't know how a show like this would work. And it was very exciting to pull a crew up that mountain, pull a crew back down that mountain, have a successful hunt, you know. And figure out that a lot of us just had no idea what we were doing outside. But what I'm really the most proud of in the whole process is that we were able to go in and like not know what we were doing and really, you know, make some mistakes on that first show. Even though we walked away with a pretty successful show, I still really like that episode.
Oh yeah, man, I thought it turned out.
Yeah. To then be able to like reassess, figure out like what we needed to tweak, how we needed to do things and be a little bit better the next time and like be a little bit better next time, be a little bit better next time. To the point where we refined it into a show that like really worked, man, where we were not a footprint that was affecting the quality of like the hunts. We understood how to act around animals. We understood how to, you know, how to make the hunting endeavor successful. But at the same time, we didn't sacrifice like the beauty and the dynamics of like the show and what we wanted to achieve in television. And that was like, that was a really tricky balance, like for reasons I said before about where the shot kind of wants to be, you know?
Yeah. I want to jump in. Cause that's something that, even just now on, we just did, you know, we just filmed a hunt right now.
Yeah.
It's one of the primary things I think about when we're out is like, for instance, I'm not having a very clear start. So we're out hunting black-tailed deer. Now you're going through coastal rainforest. It's very thick, and you come on these openings.
Yeah,
we call them musk eggs. And we get to the edge of the opening. I want to call, right? So in my mind, the perfect thing that would happen would be that I would hit the edge of the musk egg.
Yeah.
I would settle in.
Yeah.
Wiggle into the ground, like try to become the ground.
Yeah.
Or try to become a tree. And all the camera guys would just lay down.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But they know that they have to do a job.
Yeah.
And the minute any of them move, I want on one hand be like, lay down.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I'm like, well, the reason we're all here.
Yeah, that's right.
Is because they're filming.
Yeah.
It's like perfect tension, right?
What's your guys like what's your guys' perspective? I mean, do you feel me giving you the evil eye?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's not.
It's good though. 100%.
No, there's a real functional thing, right? If you don't film it, then you have no show. But if you spook the animal, then you also have no show. So there's two competing no shows that are possible. Yeah. So you're trying to figure out how to balance it. And I think what you guys did in creating this show was generally making television is about controlling all aspects.
As in, like,
setting up everything. It becomes the production becomes about the production first, subject matter second, to control it and shoot exactly how you want to do it and have the hours that you want to have and everything. And this show is about, in some ways, the hunt first, and then the camera guys have to figure it out.
That was a clear decision from the very beginning, was that the hunt would be authentic and the hunt would be the process. And we would accept whatever the outcome of that was, whether it was a failed hunt or a successful hunt. And that the what it really took was I don't brag about a lot of things. I am a excellent camera operator. And what it really took was having a team that was like kind of at that level, because the language of camera is extremely articulate. There's thousands and thousands of variations.
What does that mean?
What it means is that was trying to go on to explain that, but there's thousands of variations of what you can do with a particular shot to tell. To tell a story, right? For example, a shot that there's a couple shots that became hallmarks of this show that I was like emphatic about from the very beginning that they have to be, because I had watched some hunting shows and I had seen like things like you were talking about earlier with the separation of the raptor and the rabbit.
Yeah,
I've seen that on hunting shows where they show an animal and then they show a dude, and they feel disparate. From the very beginning, to me, I was not super interested in like the kill shot, like the perfectly framed kill shot. I was very interested in integrating the hunter into the kill shot. So the over the shoulder shot of you taking a shot at an animal was absolutely mandatory to me. It's nice because it works well in terms of how your silhouettes line up and in terms of the animal's field of view. You know, so that one actually played.
Yeah, you sort of diminish what you're diminishing what it's seeing.
Well, instead of two dudes out there, you know, you see one dude. Another one for me,
but that's important to stick on, because the effect it gives is that anyone who's ever gone hunting with their friend, or whatever, like, you know, I would spend a lot of time hunting my brothers, and just the sneaking up on something.
You're there.
You don't sneak up side by side.
No.
Like, generally, like, there's the guy. Yeah.
You're there.
If you're calling for your friend or your friend's, it's his turn or anything like that.
Yeah.
You're behind and you're sort of seeing the world through this kind of like this over the shoulder
POV
view. And it wind up, like, in doing it that way, I felt really just felt so immediate, like you were with someone in the woods.
Organic. And that was, again,
because you don't always see what's going on.
Perspective was the most important thing in developing this show. It was that we needed to put the audience in the hunt. You know, in order for a mainstream audience to accept this and like really kind of understand it, and in order to explain your philosophies and your world, we had to put them in the context. And so it had to be experiential. If we had gone in and set up a bunch of shots, you know, the audience would have instantly dismissed it. We were talking about my mentor earlier in Michael Mann. He used to say, people are like smart as people, but they're brilliant as animals. What he meant by that was that people have this extrasensory perception of when shit is just wrong and bullshit. And people know, an audience knows. If you look at shows that are out there, you know when you're being shined on. You might accept it as like entertaining and be like, oh, fine, I don't care.
But you're like, rabbits don't talk.
But from the very, right. Well, that's an extreme example.
I don't know if I would
sure.
come up with that example.
I'm thinking more like survivalist shows yeah. where you look at something and you're like, something just doesn't look right about that. That's not right. And it's it isn't right because that's the back of a Walmart.
Like I've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of days out in the woods.
Yeah.
Seldom is my face dirty.
Right.
It might get a little sweaty.
Sure.
But seldom is it dirty.
But things like that, I mean, people do pick up.
Bear.
People do pick up on things like that. And I think we knew from the beginning that we were treading on like new ground in terms of mainstream audiences and stuff like that. And that it had to be authentic. That if we broke the audience trust in any way in terms of the authenticity and what we were presenting, that we had really like lost the battle because we were trying to present a philosophy more than anything else, you know, and make it entertaining and all those things. But it really was like a philosophy, you know. So you can't lie to people. You can't like be like, here's our philosophy and we really believe this, and you're lying to them. You know what I mean? You have to tell the truth. In the language of camera, you know, the language of how you tell that is super, super important. You got to bring people into the experience. I found early on that what would happen a lot was I was following you, but I wasn't looking at you. I was looking past you, right? I was looking in the woods past you and kind of like moving from side to side and seeing you kind of pass in front of me. So that became a shot. I was like, well, that needs to be a shot. I need to put people in that experience. So another shot I came up with that I really married into the language of the show was the long lens, meaning that I'm on a more of a telephoto side of the camera, pushing past your body, which is in soft focus, in the foreground to the background, which was usually woods or something we were looking at, which is in focus. And by doing that, what I'm telling the audience is Steve's looking at those woods. Steve's examining those woods. We're now in a predatory mode. We're now down. We're hunkered like you see wolves stalk in, you know. And our focus is what's in front of us. What's happening in the foreground doesn't matter. We're looking out. We're hunting now. And that became a very important shot. That was a shot that put people in the moment that they could understand on a cerebral and like primal level. You know, like I'm saying, there's a language to all this. And there's hundreds and hundreds of shots like that. And what the art is really in doing this is knowing the context, knowing the experience, and learning when to plug those different shots in. Because this is all happening in the moment. It should be made clear to people that we didn't bullshit any of this. This was real stuff. These were real events, you know, that were happening. We just over time learned, like, you know, what technique do you plug into what hole as you go along and divulge the story? What is going to accentuate the story? What's going to bring people into that moment?
Well, what I think is important within that, too, is we talked earlier about 22 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, when I'm when I was writing my Buffalo book, okay, and I'm writing about the experience of being out looking for him in Buffalo, Now, at a lot of times in my head is stuff like, you know, man, I like, should I file for a deferment for my taxes this year? Or, yeah. or like, man, I should call my mom more often.
Yeah.
And all these other things. But that's not part of what I'm talking about. Yeah. I'm talking about Buffalo. Yeah. So you create sort of a distorted sort of, you create sort of a distorted reality about what it is you're thinking about and what it is you're talking about by highlighting certain elements of what you're talking about. In chasing 22 minutes, over the course of 7 days, 8 days, chasing 22 minutes, just in the fact that you might not be bullshitting, but you're selecting out a very, very small chunk of everything that occurred.
Definitely. Yeah.
Synthesizing.
Yeah. If well, not,
no,
it would
no,
be.
No, no, no. Synthesizing would, is not the right word. We are not, we are not synthesizing. What we're doing is condensing, and it's a distillery. We're
not, not, no, we're a, not, conden- a condense wouldn't be accurate. A condense would leave you no. 21 minutes of glassing.
Yeah.
No. And 1 minute of stalking.
I don't agree with that. It's,
We should get it out of dictionary.
It is not, it is, but it is definitely not synthesizing.
What does that mean?
Synthesizing.
Artificializing?
Synthesizing would be to construct a reality. That's not what we're doing. We're selectively distilling the process.
A selective
down.
Distillation.
I would say we are constructing an authentic version. So it is a synthesis in that it doesn't reflect the reality because the reality took place over 8 days and
right.
now it's now 22 minutes. But if you do it correctly, then it reflects the original experience in a way that is honest. You can do it in a lot of different ways. You can synthesize in a way that is totally different than that initial experience, or you can do it in a way that is pretty closely parallels what you
yeah, know. Honest is probably the key word.
Yeah,
honest.
Yeah, it's like with porn. With porn, you're not like, well, how did these two meet?
I don't know.
Left out the part where they met.
It's semantics to some degree.
It is semantics, but I think that was a very good explanation. I just, the word synthesis has a connotation to me that I guess doesn't jive with the way that I view
right.
what we do. But I understand what you're saying, and I think we're exactly on the yeah. same page.
Because there's so many versions, and the reason I respect and I'm so happy to be working on this yeah. show is that process, whether it be synthesis or distilling or condensing or any other
right,
chemical
exactly.
term
yeah.
we got going here, is that you have to figure out a way to cram in this but, yeah. experience. It's, yeah. It's long. Nobody would ever actually in Norway. They do watch this stuff slow TV. But, have you heard about this?
Eight-day show.
It's generally in America we watch 22 minutes of
yeah.
something or a very short amount of time, but we film it over this long period, and
yeah.
we want to give the audience the best version of a way that they one will watch.
It's one,
but two
yeah.
that they respect. And those two things together, man, it is really rough. It's really hard to make.
It's very difficult to make, and it requires, like, as you go through the process of making a single show, it's hundreds of decisions of, like, well, should we do this or we do that? Or now are we sliding over the edge of what's bullshit? And, you know, now are we lying? Now are we telling the truth? Now is that, you know, it's a lot of balancing like that as you go through it, because you are, you know, we can't say that this is a scientific analysis of like of an experience. It's not. I mean, we're by virtue of the fact of handing, you know, having our hands on it. You know, anytime an Avid or any other editing machine is involved in a process, you are affecting the reality. I mean, you're now writing a narrative. You know, what it is, you know, we're asking ourselves, or constantly ask ourselves as documentarians, does this fall within the bounds of what is generally perceived to be, you know, acceptable limitations on what is fair, you know, in documentary storytelling? And there's no set of rules for that, but I think we all kind of inherently, when we work in this genre, understand what those are and understand when we've crossed those boundaries. What was nice about this show is that I feel almost without exception, that we never made those calls. Even though they might have made more exciting shows, we fell within what we thought were the boundaries, because I think that's the way we just wanted to live our life, was to feel that we had done something that had some integrity, you know?
It's like a whole field of study is authenticity in documentary film. And
Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of very smart...
Do they sit right next to the wildlife biologists who want to go into documentary?
That's... Well, we had to read some of that stuff. But there's this, you know, Werner Herzog, who has made both fiction and nonfiction.
One of my favorite... I mean, one of my absolute favorite directors.
So he talks about... In documentary, there's moments that he creates through film that are more truthful than the reality of the situation.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm familiar with that line of thought.
Yeah, and in some degree, you know, that's...
But that, there was a high-profile case. I shouldn't say high-profile. There's a medium-profile case where a woman was writing a memoir about her life and hard scrabble existence and how she wanted to be a writer, but didn't get any support from her parents. And she wrote in her book and presented as fact that her father caught her with a typewriter and ceremoniously took the typewriter out and pulverized it with a sledgehammer. Turns out, her old man bought the goddamn typewriter for her. Okay. But she, in her defense, said, well, all things taken in, the way he viewed my wanting to be a writer was akin to had he smashed my typewriter. So to make that point in a way that assisted the narrative.
Yeah. No, this
right,
is...
It's a fuck... What I'm trying to say is it's like... And we've walked it many, many times. It's a very difficult balance.
Yeah, right. But she was over the edge.
No, yes. I mean, clearly, no, like, I'm pointing like, out, not, she was over the edge.
People want to classify things as either fiction or nonfiction.
Right, yeah.
And it's not a helpful... It's not helpful.
No.
That's what I would say. It's not helpful. Like, our 22-minute version show, it is an authentic version of what we experienced. But it's 22 minutes. You got to cut some stuff out. We didn't film Garrett, you know, almost dying down this mountain. Yeah. That would have been the best part of that. That would have been amazing.
The night struggle we had.
Yeah, night walk back. Like, all these things just didn't make it because
we're shooting 200 minutes each. So that's 600 minutes a day.
Yeah,
in footage.
Yeah,
is that right?
Can't put all that in a show.
Yeah. You can't.
So that's days. We shot 2,400 minutes. What is that?
It's shot how many minutes altogether?
I'd say 2,400 plus our little bonus cams here and there, 2,500
minutes.
So we're
using one out of every 100 minutes?
That's But a 1 to 100 ratio is not surprising. I shot 100 hours of footage for a 44-minute show. 100 hours of footage.
Yeah, so
we never know when the animal is actually going to be there either, so we're rolling full-time.
All the time.
Because like this hunt.
Yeah, all of a sudden it was like... and this is a perfect example of cameraman knowing what shot he needs to get, director telling, okay, I need the over the shoulder shot that Mo made as a part of the show.
I didn't make it. I just
recognize the value of getting an over the shoulder shot that contextualizes the whole experience, but cameraman and the guy he's following is just in two different locations, and if he moves, you know, I should have moved with you when you went to that next location, and I just didn't.
When he shot the deer.
Well,
I
was initially lined up over your shoulder, and I was good, and I was happy and a great two shot, perfect. I would have been down the barrel.
I know.
And then he moved, and I didn't go with him because. I was scared that I was going to get yelled at by Steve.
It's all bark and no bite. It's all bark and no bite. Like, what am I really going to do?
Well, I know.
I'm trusting. When I'm evil-eyeing and all that and yelling, whisper yelling.
It's so much harder.
Eyeball yelling?
All I'm doing, when I'm whisper yelling, All I'm doing is I'm basically saying this. I'm saying I know that you need to do your job. Do your job in the way, the best way you can that conforms to my ideal of you laying face down in the dirt.
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah. No, so yeah. Eric is saying get the shot, and I'm like, I can't move.
Yeah, but what I would say about that situation, I think you guys handled that situation perfectly. We were on exposed face with a deer looking at us, and there was no.
No, he wasn't looking at us when we set up.
No, he wasn't looking at us when we, set up.
I summoned him.
I moved because I knew if a deer popped out, it was going to blow your friggin' eardrum out, you know, from where I was sitting. So I had to get in front of you. Once we made that call, no one was going to move. We were on an exposed face.
No, and I should have anticipated that because I could have moved with you.
There was not a lot of space for you to be. But I mean, all this means to say is like you do with these things, you do the best you can with the situation you're handed, and you kind of accept what the best, you know, what the best you can do is. It's nice when you have the setup and the forethought and the time to be able to position yourself. And that for me was like a big learning curve on this show was positioning. When I got really good at it on the show, I could position to the point where I would reveal animals by moving slightly around Steve. Like in the case of the moose in Alberta, which is a beautiful reveal. And in the case of the javelina in Texas, where like I knew where the animals were going to pop out, and like I was behind it, and I could just slightly move without spooking them and reveal something that the audience hadn't yet seen, like a moose standing in front of you. But that, I mean, dude, you know, it's hard.
And
no,
you do what you can. Six people up there.
Six people.
We pulled that off.
You know, it's.
I mean, we pull it off often.
That's a lot of.
And it's going to read authentic, too.
The other thing I think happens is even just like hiking up into the area we want to hunt, we stopped at a muskeg, set up, called, nothing.
Yeah.
Stopped at a muskeg, set up, called, nothing.
Yeah.
Stopped at another muskeg, set up, called, nothing. That was before we even got to where we were going.
Yeah.
So this time, this goes on and on. We set up many places and wait, nothing happens. And you start to get, there's like a fatigue kind of sets in. Right. Like the first time, you might get, you get your rest all, I get my backpack set, just how I want to be. You know, everything's, I got my, everything's set, my scope set. You know, and I'm ready. The 11th time, you're just kind of, I was going to lean against this tree and blow the call. I'll sort the rest out later. I'm not saying you got that happens to you, but it happens to me.
Where
it's a thing that makes a good hunter is always being like, but this could be the time.
But I will say that that is something I didn't feel vulnerable to when we were really doing the show. I did not feel vulnerable to fatigue or like, oh, you know, I just don't want to do it.
No,
this time.
But I'm guilty of it, and I even get to where, like, Corey will be asking me, give me the setup. I'm gonna say, hey, we don't need a setup. We're gonna go up here, and nothing's gonna happen. You know,
yeah. Well, I just like to know where to be. Like you're telling me,
but
you're like,
hey,
you stick out like a sore thumb. So I was about ready to change my clothes. I was up there in fluorescent green. Had just,
but it would have been helpful. It would have been helpful.
Changed the battery.
Had I explained,
but yeah. Right,
it would have been helpful had I said an hour ago, whatever the hell it was, we saw a deer. We watched a deer.
Well, I know we saw a deer, and you know,
no, but I mean, just for not me helpful for you, helpful for the show.
The show, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Had I done we've now arrived at where we feel like a deer vanished.
Yeah.
We're going to blow a call and hopefully he'll pop his head up.
Well,
but I'm like, I've been saying that for 3 days, dude. Two days.
Dude, I remember having some epic fights with you, man, in the field about like, oh, dude, just please tell us what's going on right now. And like day 7 or 8 or whatever on Oddad, you know, when we were going up after him, I was like, please just tell me. But I understand like the fatigue of just like day in, day out, setting things up that then didn't pan out that are just going to hit the editing room floor. Absolutely not making the show. So all of your ideas, emotional energy, all the stuff you put into producing content,
it's like trying to wipe the slate clean and say, like, I'm sorry, man, I know you worked really hard on that, but it's a complete waste now. Now you have to reset it up. Now you have to redo it again. And after a while, man, that's just so draining, dude. It's hard to do that over and over again.
And I start to feel embarrassed.
Yeah.
You start to get like, because you're talking to the camera, but you're in a way you're talking to the guy holding the camera.
Definitely. That's a whole nother thing we should talk about. But
so, yeah. You know, it's like, you know, just like on this trip, Corey be like, okay, what's going on? And you feel like, dude, I've been telling you. I mean, you really want me to tell you this again?
Yeah,
there might be a deer over there.
Are you listening? This is an interesting thing because the relationship between specifically in this, usually it's the relationship between the director and the subject. But in this, it really is a relationship between the camera operator, or the director of photography, and the subject. Because you guys got the point of contact. It can't, you know, a director, we just, in this context, you really don't need another person walking out into the field of view of all these animals, you know. So the camera operator directs a lot of that interaction and that relationship. And it's a hard position to be in because you're asking really, really obvious questions that you know. But that you know that the audience needs to know. So you're like, I'd be often asking you things that you're like, dude, you know? Like,
yeah.
You know that. And I'd be like, yeah, dude, I know that. But I just need you to say it.
Yeah.
You know? And there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of trust and stuff involved in that. There's a lot of, like, development of relationship involved in that, you know?
That's the thing I found is there's a benefit to working with people you had, camera operators you haven't worked with, and there's a benefit to the ones you have worked with. Definitely. The ones you haven't worked with is we'll be going through the woods, and I'll see something, and if it's a guy I don't know or don't know well, I'm always turning on being like, well, turning to him meaning turning to the camera.
Yes.
I mean, like, hey, check this out. So what happens is, you know, I'm all excited to, like, introduce him to this new subject.
Yep, exactly.
And I'd be like, you see this? You know, he'll do that, and he'll go do this, and, you know, you see where bear, he'll... And then later, when you've... It's like... Then later, when you're with someone you've had many experiences with, you're kind of like, yeah, they already know all that shit anyways.
Right.
You just kind of go into the woods. The advantage of the person you know is you get a real eye contact thing.
Yeah.
Where I'll be like, we're sitting there for hours. I'll have something I also want to say. And just, you know, I turn or raise my finger.
Yeah.
And we're doing it. And I'd kind of like just little signals. I'm making signals so you can see my hands, listen to a podcast. But a little signal says a lot. Like a little signal says, like, no, I mean, seriously, there's something standing right here.
Yeah.
The way I'm waving my hand right now, we both know means like this thing is extremely close.
Yeah.
And there's a shorthand that develops that's helpful for, it's helpful for actually hunting, but it's not helpful for doing the story.
It's helpful for functionality. And what you like ultimately hope is that you kind of have both of those. And that's a big part of like, you know, a big part of directing this kind of stuff is learning how to establish a relationship but not contaminate the subject, right? And how to continually pump the subject. We're like, I have found that in like documentary directing and a lot of documentary directing, the most powerful weapon that I have as a director to try to move the story forward, to try to help the host progress the story, divulge information, stuff like that, is a smile. It's the weirdest thing. It's not talking. It's a facial expression of interest. So a lot of times when I'm working, like I'll work with chefs on these long projects. I just finished one. It was 7 months of working with a chef that I didn't particularly get along with. But I spent less of my time talking to him and more of my time smiling and nodding and being very interested in what he was saying, with a couple little questions here and there, kind of pulling him along.
it's an interesting thing. It becomes emotionally draining, and it's hard to do. It's harder than you would think it would be to do, but that kind of interaction and like freshness of interest, you know, on my part really can help pull that information out. And
I would just say, watching both Mo and Eric just during this whole shoot, I worked with some directors that just are constantly exerting their own ego on the situation.
Yeah, that's a big mistake.
And I've worked with these, you know, guys that have been in the industry for a long time, and that's what they do. They just are constantly basically like trying to get the host to basically say what they want to say, like in this very forceful kind of, and it is terrible. I mean, there are times, you know, to kind of jump in and try to direct things certain ways, but basically, to be hands off in a way and like use subtlety, is, man, way more skillful and leads to such a better product than
it definitely does. And what I do when I go into a situation, less with Steve, because Steve and I like always had a real natural simpatico in working together. But in working with people that I have more difficulty with, I'll go into a scene with like two or three things that I do want the host to say. But 95% of what I'm getting them to deliver are their own ideas.
You want them to say, or like things you want them to convey?
Concepts
that I want them to convey.
Touch on.
Not specific dialogue, because I don't care how it comes out. But ideas that I know are important to the story arc we're trying to tell. Most of what I'll spend my time doing is, again, it's smiling and nodding and encouraging them to feel empowered to divulge their information and their ideas, and to feel like their ideas are valid, you know, and to feel like they have a voice and are empowered. You know, that's super important. And when a host feels confident, when a host feels like they're doing a good job and in control, like the camera reads that 100%. I mean, that makes a good host. That's someone the audience can look at and be like, well, this is someone who clearly feels comfortable in their environment, comfortable in the information they're divulging, you know. And then every once in a while, I'll pepper in like, hey, remember when we talked about this? Yeah. You know, and what you're constantly trying to do is, again, like empower the host. Remember when you said this? Remember when we talked about this? Remember when you had that idea of this? Remember when, you know, those kinds of things. Again, it the host has a feeling then that they're coming up with a natural, organic idea. A lot of times they are, by the way, because it's all information that I got in pre-production interviews, you know, and stuff like that. It's just that I know that right now is the time to say that.
And you need it delivered in a usable way at a usable time.
But I want it not just delivered in a usable way in like a soundbite. I want it delivered in a confident way where the host feels comfortable and organic. And those, again, when you talk about like the human bullshit meter, when people are watching TV and they see someone that's empowered and feels like they really understand the context and feel good about what they're delivering, people buy that, man. People buy it.
Mo, did you feel, I mean, you were on camera this episode. Did you feel that feeling that hosts probably feel often about, am I saying the right thing, or am I coming across in like the right way? Like, if there's a funny sensitivity or ego that comes with being on camera that's different from being behind the camera, where you do think like, oh, I just said a bunch of shit. Am I saying the right? Like, is this good shit? Because in some ways, not that you're making it up, but you're. You know you're on camera. It's not like it's hidden.
You almost like create a character, right?
Yeah, it's a performative thing, and you want to be like coming across in a good way and not like a douchey way or whatever. You know, you want to not be failing,
or you don't care.
Yeah, because you'll have conversations all the time, and we did too.
Yeah,
where Mo will say like, "Hey, what's the with this?" Or do you remember that time? And he'll be like, "Oh no, never mind," because I'm gonna take my authentic question, my authentic recollection,
save it,
yeah. And keep its authenticity, but then wedge it in where I need it to live.
Right.
So it's like the impetus to say it is perfectly natural. Yeah. It's something you're really honestly curious about, but I'm gonna have to suspend the gratification of getting my answer in order to get my answer at a time that becomes usable for the production.
Yeah, so
it's
useful.
It's like bullshit, but not at all bullshit. It's just like a reshuffling. It's like a reshuffling of reality. You know?
I can say that there's nothing I said up here in the context of the show that I don't like 100% believe in my heart or aren't my feelings about this whole, you know, greater subject. None of it was made up, and I didn't sit down like on the plane ride up here and like articulate the points that I thought would make me look cool or whatever, you know. But there definitely was a lot of moments going along where I was like, yeah, I shouldn't ask that question right now, you know, or I shouldn't say that right now. Like, I know, you know, that we're going to end with a meal scene, right? Like, those are thoughts that you want to save for that meal scene because, like, I want a nice, impactful ending that has emotional quality and, like, that people can, that kind of buttons the idea up. And,
yep.
You know, and I know that, like, when we're starting out, I want to, you know, set up a couple basic principles that are going to, you know, guide us through or set us on the right trajectory to kind of tell this story, you know.
If I have something I'm very passionate about,
yeah,
an observation that I'm wed to, I'll go against my own instincts and stick it in multiple places.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to, like, I'm hedging my bet. I'm trying to make sure.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'll say some point.
Yeah.
And then it's almost painful to me, but I'll do it. Like, I'm going to do my point again.
I know.
And then I'm going to do my point again later.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the only thing I do that many times. And I'm sort of like, I'm sort of pushing this idea that this idea has to be there. And you have a variety of ways to use it.
But I know, as we go through these hunts, there's a lot of different ways that the hunt can play out. When we were up there, like, you know, you'll deliver some idea and we still haven't completed a successful hunt. And it could be that we don't end up with a successful hunt. And that moment that you delivered that idea is the most exciting moment in the show, you know? But it also could be that we then run into a lot of exciting stuff, a lot of things that happen after that you're like, okay, well, I know that stuff before is getting cut out. So if I want to get this idea across, I got to interject it. Because from an editorial standpoint and from a standpoint of telling a show that's like coherent in the language of television, they can't cut to some moment in some place that we've never even seen in the show that we didn't establish where you're saying something awesome, but makes absolutely no sense, you know, because you're like, wait a second, how the hell did he get there? And where did that jacket come from? You know, it has to be that. I mean, there are rules to this. There are rules to how a show unfolds. If we could just make a quilt, you know, like approach the show like a patchwork quilt and just plug a bunch of stuff in from a bunch of different places and whatever, we could make
choose your own adventure,
a very articulate story that you could write down on paper word for word and read it and be like, wow, that is just a brilliantly told story.
Yeah.
But the visuals on screen would make absolutely no sense. It'd be like a bad acid trip. That was a really clear decision from the very, very beginning that we were not going to use interviews. And when you don't, when you use interviews, you by default, de facto, you do not have a cinematic show. No, bullshit. Yeah, I see.
Touching the Void?
What's that?
Touching the Void seems really cinematic to me.
That's a good point.
Based on interviews, 100% recreations, no footage of the actual event. Amazing film.
Yeah, I need to think about that for a second, but I need to think about it because it is an amazing
film. I agree in general.
And by the way, like
like, I give you tons of props for that pull that fast.
We were just talking about
because
I went to film school too, man.
You definitely stumped me on that one. But
no, I would agree with your
principle, in general terms, yeah, you break the momentum of a cinematic story when you cut to an interview. An interview, again,
it takes you out of it. Yeah.
Again, you know, people are brilliant animals, and they understand at some level that you're now going into some contrived, controlled environment with a controlled scenario, which is this guy delivering a line of dialogue that perfectly ties everything together. There needs to be in...
Where did doing shows like that come from?
What, the interview?
Talking Heads.
Who invented that? No, like where you have people doing little interactions, but then they're commenting on their own interactions.
It's efficient.
Well,
no, but where? Who came? What show did it first?
News magazine shows before reality TV were very manipulative in how they.
I think that's a good
call. People answer questions. They would phrase questions in a way that basically and cut the interviews in a way that made them say certain things. And I think it went from that into certain forms of reality TV where they really constructed these interviews. And then I think it was just a natural progression.
I think that's a smart assessment. I'm going to come back to touching the void for a second. If you could have told that story in a purely verite sense, you would have. But there were
Touching the void?
Touching the void. But there were no cameras. So they had to go to a recreation basis. So
out of sympathy for the viewers, listeners, touching the void.
It's a film.
It's about a mountaineering accident, a mountaineering disaster that was not being filmed when it happened.
What mountain range?
You know,
it's the
Cordillera Blanca.
No, Cordillera Blanca Range.
Yeah, Peru. Is that Peru?
In Peru, yeah.
So the two
Corey's been
people. It involved a fellow who had to cut his climbing partner loose, not knowing, couldn't see his climbing partner, didn't know if he's dead or alive. He's hanging on a rope below him. And cuts the rope. And the only way to tell the story is these two men are interviewed exhaustively. And there's some very artful recreations that never make you feel like you're actually watching it happen. You're very aware that it's...
So let me
and it wasn't like the old History Channel style recreation where everything gets kind of hazy.
Right. Let me continue on here because I do... this. That was an important point and like a good example. It is a documentary in the technical sense. You can't deny that it's a documentary, but it is not verite.
And
verite for the audience too is like a fancy term for real shit happening.
The French figured it out.
Right.
Chronicle of a Summer.
And so what we're doing in these shows is really verite.
Absolutely.
And so That to me is where the difference is. When you're intercutting interviews into recreations that are obviously understood by the audience to be recreations, that's one thing. And it's a beautiful documentary. Sort of it's a brilliantly told story.
Probably to fiction filmmaking. And the guy was a fiction.
It is closer to fiction filmmaking. Yeah, when you're cutting interviews into verite, what is supposed to be reality, that to me is when you're breaking it. The real skill of ZPZ, of the company we work for, is that we over time have learned how to make cinematic verite, how to make choices in framing and cinematography, in music, and you know.
I would say maybe not most importantly, but very up there. Very good writing.
Excellent writing. Yeah. What we do is we take a bunch of ideas that come from feature filmmaking, from cinematic, you know, produced feature film or narrative television making, and we apply them to verite format. You know, that to me is what has been successful. The second you cut to an interview, a talking head interview out of that, you break that momentum. And I guess that's what I meant for clarification on what I was saying before is you can't
in this kind of show, you can't do that. To me, you can't do that.
Along those lines, in terms of talking about verite, a lot of that, you know, circles back to acceptance. And we were talking about this scenario where you were caught out and you couldn't get behind Mo. For you guys, you know, Mo and Steve, it's something you guys talked about earlier, but that transition and that struggle of accepting a non-successful hunt, you know, which was the reality of the scenario, which doesn't necessarily equate to, you know, the button that you want to put on a television show or a film. What was that transition like? Did you feel, you know, a lot of anxiety around a possible non-successful hunt? I mean, where, you know, was it a mutual anxiety? Like, how did you guys overcome that? Because frankly, from watching the show progress, some of the most successful, some of the most entertaining shows that I've watched are ones that you haven't.
Yeah.
No, I thought that you couldn't do it. I thought you had to just throw it all in the garbage.
Yeah. No, I think that was a big, I mean, that was a big leap of faith early on
it wasn't my idea because I argued against it.
I know.
What was your argument?
Just have to scrap it.
Scrap it. Shoot a new episode.
Yeah.
And we got an email one time, a guy saying, I've had a lot of failure in my life. I do not need to go and see you go out and fail.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't want to.
Which almost made me feel bad for the guy.
I don't want to go to dinner with that guy. I actually do feel bad for that guy as well, man, because I think he's missing the greater point.
But generally, it was well received, but I argued vehemently. It was the fourth one we did.
Yeah.
I argued that it was like, there's just no way. It sucks. Yes, we'll figure something out. We'll go to my mom's and hunt squirrels in her yard. Like,
it was a great show.
There's like a way that we don't have to use this because you can't have a hunting show where someone doesn't get something.
Yeah, but you know what happened in that show? It was the goat hunt
But are you saying you didn't have any anxiety or concern about this?
Well, of course I did.
Yeah.
I'm a human being.
Yeah.
You know, it
but I don't remember I don't remember being worried about it.
No, I was confident in it. Well, no, I was a little worried about it, but I was confident that we had made a good show. But what happened and the reason that I argued for it and that I thought it would be successful is that what happened is all of a sudden by not coming home with a goat on that show, the subject matter of the show changed. It no longer was a show about a goat hunt. The goat hunt was the structure for the show, but what the show was about was you and your brother. And your writing and the way that you handled the writing, especially of the end of the last act and how that played out, made it a show about spending time with Danny and how important that was. And it was an aha moment because it was like all of a sudden it was like, wait a second, guys, there's a whole world here of stuff that we haven't explored. It's not just about hunting, you know, it's about life and philosophy and like in the, you know, the relationships you have and the way that you experience the world, like any of these subject matters, any of these things can be the driving force of the story or the conclusion to a story. We go out and hunt, you know, we're successful, we're not successful, whatever. But there's a huge takeaway from the audience in hearing about why it's important to go out and like spend time with your brother and have that kind of connection and that kind of bond and to be able to make a smart and accurate judgment call in the moment and be like, it's a nanny, and a moral judgment, which some people may agree with or may not agree with. And I'm not casting judgment on where people would fall on it, but to say like, well, technically I'm legally allowed to shoot a nanny, but you really shouldn't, and I don't want to. And
encourage not to.
And encourage people.
Encourage not to buy fishing game, but allowed to do it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think that a lot of things on that episode, for me, it's a real benchmark episode because a lot of those things came together and like it really was like a light bulb coming on. It was like, wait a second, guys, there's a whole nother world here. We don't need to feel the tremendous pressure that we've been feeling to go out and have these successful hunts. Like, we can now tell more nuanced and articulate stories about the human experience, and they don't have to be predicated on a kill shot at the end. You know, not to say there's anything wrong with that. It's great, you know. But we told a lot of great shows, you know, a lot of great stories after that that were about a varying degree, you know, varying amount of subject matters that didn't have to do with necessarily killing an animal.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what's given the show integrity and legs over time. We got a lot of stuff we can fall back on, a lot of stories we can tell, and a lot more we can tell in the future, you know.
Dirt myth.
Authenticity is an entire...
This is your concluding thought now.
I got two, actually. I've thought of this.
Can you also talk about where you're at with chewing tobacco right now? I mean, just like... Because you quit for a while in the car the other day.
I quit, yeah. Baby
Six
steps.
Hours.
Baby steps. Yeah, I'm being supported by my friends and coworkers on quitting a horrible addiction. But my concluding thoughts...
No, one more minute. Do you see yourself chewing in a year?
No.
See yourself chewing in 1 month?
I'm going to quit tomorrow.
No, don't bullshit.
No, I'm going to say that's what I always think. And then
But you don't see yourself chewing in a year?
No.
Do you see yourself chewing in a month?
Yeah.
Do you see yourself chewing, in 6 months?
Probably, yeah.
Okay, just trying to get a sense of...
Do you see yourself chewing in 11 months and 29 days?
Probably a lot, and then I'm quitting.
Oh, okay. All right. So this is like a benchmark moment. Like one year
as of now.
I'm
write the date down.
History's being made.
Right. But yeah, no, lay your concluding thoughts out. I don't know why I'm so worried. I just don't want to see you develop a hole in your lip.
I know. No, I appreciate that, too. It comes with love. But the concluding thoughts, I think that the really cool thing I've been witness to, and this is my 15th, so I'm new, but I'm also...
15 episodes.
Yeah.
Man, you're
a meat eater.
Yeah.
15's so there's 80.
You're an old hand,
80
man.
Total. Yeah. So you're like...
I don't know how many there are total. A lot.
There's a lot. There's a like... Lot. Yeah, we were talking about it.
How many without kill shots?
Well, home, it's over 80.
Okay, over 80.
But something that I've seen and that was spoken about tonight that's really cool is the crew has to be authentic to basically make it.
Yes.
And... With that being said, that makes all that we're talking about possible is it's all people who are willing to put that effort in to get the authenticity.
Yeah. People, it's got to be people who enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. When we're talking about like issues like that, I'm always like, does he like running around out in the woods?
Yeah, exactly. You can't. Yeah. Yeah.
Because that'll be helpful.
That's going to be a lot of it. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what's great is how many non-hunters are sitting here right now.
Yeah.
For
sure, man.
And, man.
That's because of the ethos of the show, man.
Yeah. That has a lot to do with,
you know,
the development really of the show and Steve, who Steve is, and just...
No and the one diehard hunter we had has got a gimpy knee now.
Yeah, so yeah.
Second concluding thought. Was if you died, ABCs.
Like if I actually died right now.
Yeah. Airway, breathing, circulation. I check all that shit.
Before doing the podcast.
Yeah.
And then continue the podcast.
And if it's still flatline, I hit the spot, and yeah, we'd continue rolling. But that's my concluding thoughts.
I like that. That's good, nerd, man.
Yeah.
Corey? Right.
No, it's great to work with Mo and like, you know, kind of, he's like the founder of the show on the cinematic end of things and... You know, listening to him tonight and like learning some true wisdom coming from a person who like kind of developed the show or helped develop the show. And then like, you know, a second thought is why we kind of all got into working in this adventure, filmmaking, adventure television is like, you know, it's like anything you struggle. It's like life. You struggle to attain this main goal, which maybe is like, the main goal is to create our best television show we can, whether that's, you know, along the way carrying 100-pound packs up the steepest stuff you can imagine, like almost falling face first multiple times or like stressing about your shot placement or as a cameraman or like where you need to be. And like in the end, it all works out and like having, you know, building camaraderie within this 1 week with everyone with the same goal in mind, you know, it's kind of fulfilling.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, another great POW show.
P.O. Dubs.
P.O. Dubs.
Where stories are made.
And rain.
A little bit of rain.
No, and the other thing that I think people need to know.
Oh, you're skipping your turn.
Oh, man. All right. Do it.
Does the system do it?
I like skipping turns. That was what I was going to say.
Closing thoughts.
Not skipping your. I didn't mean skipping your turn. You got what I meant.
Jumping the gun.
High holing.
I'm definitely that guy.
For me, it's really nice to come out here and see like that the show's in like such good hands. I mean, you guys, I think, do like a tremendous job, man. I know how I'm one of the few people that knows how hard this job is, and it is very difficult, you know, to shoot this show. And I think you guys do a great job. And the other thing is just the satisfaction of, you know, of being here 6 years later and still having a successful show up and running with no signs of weakening. You know, I mean, that is a very rare thing in television, to be a part of something at the beginning and see it be successful and maintain its integrity throughout a lifespan. 80 shows is no joke by any, you know, stretch of the imagination. There's no reason to think that it won't be 100, 100 plus. And those are real rarities in what we do. You know, most of the time you're working on a show that gets canceled after the first season.
Yeah.
Most of the time you're working on some show that's a pitch that never sees the light of day. There's hundreds of them, you know. I've had the benefit of working on a couple with legs that really run. And for me, this one, for a number of reasons, has been the most important and the most fulfilling over time. And has done more to shape who I am, today, in my belief system than any other. So it's been a tremendous gift, Yeah. So.
I can't really follow that. Whatever I'm going to say. Yeah.
Tell them about how when they're watching a wildlife.
No, I'm
they're
not
watching
going to.
A wildlife sequence. How what they don't realize is there's 100 people standing there filming the same thing.
And camel.
There's a lot of. Well, I'm not going to talk about that either. But what I am going to say is this is a very physical job. And I'm always. Like, I think of myself as somebody that's. You know, like in some ways, exceptionally fit to be able to like.
Yeah, you're always cruising right along. What are you gonna say? You're not.
No, I'm fine. But everybody else carrying like, I'm just impressed with the crew that's on the show.
It's a great crew.
Everybody, how much shit they're carrying.
And yeah, did you know I had all my dive weights in my pack?
Yeah. Exactly. No, and it's crazy.
I forgot them in there. I forgot they were in there.
But didn't even notice.
You know, it's like a club of some sense that you're a part of. It's to film a show like this.
Rogan called it a tribe.
Yeah. And yes, when people go hiking, everybody's tired hiking. But when you're hiking with extra film stuff and then you're running ahead.
Yeah.
And like doing just weird things that you would never do as a normal person.
Yeah.
And I like to think, okay, I am somebody that can do this weird thing. But then you see like six other people doing this, and you're like, what the hell? There's other people that are also this, and it's a really strange set of folks that enjoy this type of activity. And I like that there's. The folks that have worked on Meat Eater have gone on to do other, you know, bigger, better things, but they look at Meat Eater as a place where that is very, I don't know, very fulfilling. And I think everybody wants, when they work, to do something that's fulfilling, and it's cool to be a part of a group that is fulfilled by working on a show, because there's a lot of TV that is the opposite of this,
But you work on something, you feel good about it, and hopefully people enjoy it.
And that's, yeah, and then later when they become traders, they still look back.
No, but it's, yeah.
Eric? Just piggybacking off of everyone's points, I think it is a bit of a tribe, I think. You know, if when you meet someone that has worked on this show and inherently a part of that process, you know, struggled through probably some intense weather conditions and some long, long days and long nights, you immediately feel bonded with that person. And I think you guys were talking about it earlier. It kind of also redefines, you know, fun in the moment. It feels arduous, but those are frankly some of the best experiences I've ever had, and some of the best stories that I tell are stories from meat eater shoots, you know, stories and experiences I had with you, Steve, or crew members here. And these are guys, you know, half these guys I just met like 3 or 4 days ago and will now walk away, you know, calling them without a question my friends. And so I think that is a really, really unique, you know, platform and, you know, experience that Meat Eater gives you every time you come out, whether you're working on it. And hopefully that's something that people take away with, you know, their audience members that watch this.
For my concluding thought, I want to talk about something someone said to me at the first TV meeting I ever went to. And it's applicable to life in general, I think, where it was someone named Gloria Fan, who I still keep in touch with, a producer. And I went out and met with her and some other people in Los Angeles in, I think, 2004, or 2005. And we sat down in a room and we were going to talk about trying to do something with hunting and other ideas. And the first thing she says is it's impossible to get anything made. Nothing gets done. It's just one frustration after the other, and it leads nowhere. With that, let's get started. All right. Thanks for tuning in.
It's the documentary episode. There wasn't a lot about hunting in this episode. It was a lot of, yeah, if you want to go to film school, then listen.
Yeah, go to biology first. All right.
That was fun.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
Cool. Thank you.